That's great, you know, and I like the way that you addressed it too. And perhaps for the remaining two panelists, and the way that you unpack this problem is to sort of address both the hardware and the software side of it. You know, so what you see as sort of Taiwan's role in the naval rebalance to Asia. Maybe anyone else? Next, Alex or
please.
David. Sure. So I'll address Taiwan's role in U.S. rebalance by starting with U.S.-Taiwan maritime cooperation. I'm more optimistic at the moment. I'm fairly more optimistic about the current activities that the U.S. has with Taiwan. So to share a story, started in 2009, my first year at State Department. I was there, and then a hurricane was moving up the coast in the West Pacific toward Taiwan. And then the U.S. government felt like these countries that are affected in Asia should be able to handle themselves. A day or two after the hurricane touched ground in Taiwan, I started to receive personal emails from friends of friends that I met years ago in Taipei saying the situation in Taiwan is more dire than the international news is reporting. And I thought, well, I think I'm all the way in Washington. I don't have the information on the ground. So is it really that serious? And I picked up the phone and called AIT Washington Greg Mann and said, hey, this hurricane hit Taiwan. And is there something that, what can we be doing? We should be getting ready to help. And then we started talking, and he said, well, you know, the U.S. government, we need the president, Taiwan president's authorization and official request. So, and I said, but we should be thinking about it. So I started asking the questions, because this is more of a DOD type lead for maritime ops. Messages and emails and phone calls to AIT Taipei, PAYCOM, Pentagon OSD policy. Same response, you know, we start getting ready, but nothing, we can't really move forward. Then Taiwan's president did make the request for the U.S. to help, and this is when DOD really took the lead. I'm just there to ask a few questions and check up for Hurricane Morakot, right? Over 400 Taiwan lives passed away, U.S. sending the USS, this is the Denver, plus excavation equipment and plastic sheeting and all this. So this is an example where you have like the U.S. Naval vessel flying heavy lift helicopter sorties into Taiwan back in 2009. So I see this maritime interaction, this maritime support that the U.S. and Taiwan has. And I see that, and I also see a lot of other examples with Taiwan or as an observer in RIMPAC. And U.S. Arms sales, naval weapons like submarine launch harpoon missiles as more examples of U.S. support for Taiwan in accordance to the Taiwan Relations Act. And I mentioned the big potential with humanitarian assistance disaster relief, much like the Hurricane Morakot situation. I would like to reemphasize a point that was made in this room 3 weeks ago at a separate public seminar panel with David Keegan, former AIT Deputy Director, AIT Taipei. And he was saying that Taiwan's and U.S. Maritime various defense cooperation is more effective when it is quiet. So in the government, there was a lot going on between U.S. and Taiwan, and a lot of that is just quietly done. And you could say that there's a benefit if you made it public, because maybe this kind of cooperation could be more of a symbol of U.S. support for Taiwan. However, if you make it public, David Keegan was saying, then you open up space for other countries to come in and influence decision makers. Other countries come in to demarsh U.S. decision makers and to increase the costs and lead to maybe not as good of results in U.S.-Taiwan cooperation. So with the quiet cooperation, that presents a problem, because if you see in the news 5 or 10 aspects or activities of U.S.-Taiwan cooperation, a lot of it's quiet, then maybe there's another 10, maybe there's another 100 things going on, but we just don't really see it. But there is accountability here. The executive branch does regularly meet with the legislative branch, so because we're in a U.S. democracy. So there's back and forth, and the legislative branch is kept aware of this. So I think given this outline, there's more to do, of course. A lot of it's quiet, like I said. And I think that Taiwan does play an active role in the U.S. rebalance to Asia. And as a matter of fact, this is we're working on this as a first quarterly report here at Global Taiwan Institute. So we're actively exploring this topic more. And hopefully we can try to get Kurt Campbell here to speak on that. So we'll see.
Ian, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, I would just push back a little bit on the notion that it's better if it's quiet. I would disagree. I remember the Father's Day Typhoon Morakot. I was in Taipei. And I'll never forget that night, because I was in a car accident because of the heavy rain coming down and the slippery streets. And I was actually planning to go down to Kaohsiung that night, but the bullet train got frozen because of the typhoon. which ended up turning at the last minute. We all expected it was going to hit us in Taipei. It turned at the last minute and hit Kaohsiung instead, and then resulted in absolute terrible tragedy. This is an example of why quiet is not good. Because for those Americans that lived in Taiwan, we had no idea that USS Denver was there. I found out a few days later at AIT, I was there renewing my passport or something very boring like that, just going through the process. And there were a couple naval sailors that were there from the U.S. Navy, from the USS Denver, that had got left behind. And they had to go and meet our naval attaché at AIT, and they had no documents, and they had to meet our naval attaché in order to get through the process, to get their documents, identify who they were, and to get back to their ship. And it was completely dysfunctional. To see that the way that they interacted, to see that the way we conducted that operation, at a time when people were literally buried alive under mud and dying, and were so slow that we can't proactively reach out to Taiwan at the military level, at the State Department level. We have to wait for the president of Taiwan to make the first move. Because again, we're paralyzed. We're so afraid to do anything related to Taiwan that we would rather trade away the lives of those people that could have, notionally, because you can't prove the counterfactual, but notionally who could have been saved. Even if it was just one person. If the U.S. Navy could have gotten there sooner, if the U.S. Marines could have gotten there sooner and stayed on the ground. Instead, the way they conducted that operation, while again, I think the operation was a success and it was a wonderful thing, they had to conduct the operation with a heavy weight of political pressure hanging over their heads, which meant that sailors couldn't spend the night in Taiwan. And so then people got left behind in all the chaos of that situation. That is just one example of many. If you look at the earthquake last year, when you had entire buildings collapsing, what was the U.S.? If that was Japan or South Korea, we would have been there in hours. Where were we with Taiwan? So this idea that, oh, don't worry, America, don't worry, American public, we're really doing so many wonderful things with Taiwan, we just can't tell you about it. To me, I don't see it. As someone who lived in Taiwan for 5 years and someone who regularly goes there and speaks to people in Congress who are really unhappy with our policy, I just don't see it. I think that by cowering in the dark as if this was an illicit relationship we have, it is below us as a country. And it treats Taiwan as if it's some kind of renegade state like North Korea, instead of a prosperous, thriving democracy who is a responsible stakeholder. And why do we do it? Because we're afraid of a country who's not a responsible stakeholder. I personally think that's wrong. So there are a lot of things that we could do publicly because it would be more effective on the ground and it would save more lives. And we should also do it because it's in our principled interest to show that we support other democracies, to send that strategic signal.
Mm-hmm. Alex, you want to take a stab at the...
Sure. So I think there are a number of places where we can cooperate to great benefit to both sides. One, I think you may have heard about a set of initiatives that the United States is pursuing under this administration. I guess most recently it's being called the Maritime Security Initiative. But that, which is a $500 million over 5 years, something like $445 million over 5 years, pot of money that the Pentagon is using to build partner capacity with countries that we work with in the Asia Pacific, and one component of that is an effort to increase maritime domain awareness and develop what some people call a common operational picture. So some colleagues of mine from CNAS have a great report. It's called Networked Transparency, and it's about this very issue. So we're spending this money to try and increase the surveillance capabilities of our partners in the Asia Pacific. 80% of the money was supposed to be earmarked for the Philippines, but we'll see what happens there. As Ian has written very convincingly, Taiwan is actually needs a lot less of, doesn't really need much help because they have an excellent maritime domain awareness capability. throughout the kind of linchpin of what some refer to as the first island chain. And so I think it would be in the United States' benefit interest to, as it shapes, seeks to shape a regional information sharing network, to get Taiwan involved in some way or another. Anytime you're negotiating an arrangement with, you know, near on a dozen countries, things are of course quite difficult. And you know, not every country in the region has excellent relations with Taiwan. So but I think it's worth, you know, the juice would be worth the squeeze in terms of facilitating Taiwan's participation in that enterprise. I think on the training aspect of things, I think, you know, the United States is building significant military facilities in Guam, or plans to, pending, you know, military construction. And, you know, that's not as far as San Diego or Hawaii or any other place. So I think there is the potential if national political leaders decide that they don't want to take the risk at any particular time of, say, sending U.S. Forces to Taiwan for some extended training arrangement, which, you know, whether or not you like it is a risk, does carry a political risk. If they don't want to do that, the ROCN can send some folks to Guam, and we can, you know, cooperate, or the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, and we can cooperate on, you know, in sort of U.S. territory, and really work on some important exercises together. I think also on the software side, I think the United States should make greater efforts to share expertise on some of the things that we're working on in the Pentagon. So incorporating commercial off-the-shelf technologies, you know, many of the game-changing military technologies, think of artificial intelligence, you know, or certain types of advanced computing, are occurring in the commercial realm, and have synergies with Taiwan's own competitive advantages in information technology and processing and a number of things. And so, as we figure out what this is going to look like for the United States, I think it would behoove us to share some of those lessons with Taiwan. And similarly, I think. I would echo Ian's comments on the professionalism of the Taiwan military, and I think that will be only enhanced by the transition to an all-volunteer force. But if you read the history of the United States transition to the AVF, it was a bumpy road, and comes with significant costs, financial costs, that is. Which will put pressure on Taiwan's already constrained military budget. So getting dialogue going on that issue will be tremendously important. And then on the hardware issue, which I know everyone always wants to talk about, but I'm much less sanguine about the benefits of Taiwan acquiring on its own, you know, through indigenous development or directly from the United States, really lumpy capital, right? So that's big, expensive platforms that Taiwan can only acquire a few of. I mean, you know, we authorized the sale of 4 Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates to Taiwan, and they're only going to buy 2, right? Am I correct? Can you fact check me on that? That's right. Okay, good. you know, so Taiwan can only ever acquire a few of these things that it would like to have, like big diesel-electric submarines, fifth-generation fighter jets. And so, you know, I mean, a cynic, which I am not, would say that these lumpy capabilities are going to get plinked like that in the event of a conflict with the PRC, and all of that investment is going to be essentially useless. And I don't think that Taiwan can acquire enough of them to make them an effective deterrent. So, again, these kinds of decisions need to be taken in close consultation with Taiwan, in close consultation with Capitol Hill, and everybody is going to have voices on these issues. But I think, just as a general matter, Taiwan should be shifting its, as the United States is having to reckon with as well, in an environment where precision guided munitions are, widely available to countries, and of course, the PRC has them in spades. The move to distributed, asymmetric, small, survivable capabilities is something that everyone is going to have to undertake in the years ahead. So acquiring lots of lumpy capital now that's going to be in the ROC armed forces for the next, several decades is probably not a wise decision. Now, I think the submarines in particular are good because they focus on the psychological aspects of deterrence. Because submarines are hard to track, unless you can destroy them in port, they can greatly, the uncertainty about where they are can greatly complicate an adversary's force planning. But big diesel electric submarines are not necessarily the sort of epitome of that concept, and I think Taiwan should think hard about pushing that even further. Things are changing very rapidly in undersea autonomy, and the undersea realm in general is changing under our feet, so to speak. So I recognize that the political symbolism of whatever capability, F-16s or what have you, is important in addition to the military, function, sort of objective military value. But I think in this case, Taiwan it will be imposing costs on itself in a military sense that may outweigh the political symbolism of commitment of the United States and stuff like that. So we should be working together more with Taiwan. We can signal that commitment in other ways. I don't think F-16 CDs are necessarily the best way to do that.
Thanks, Alex. And I want to get to audience questions, but since you raised it, I want to bring this question out to the other panelists as well, and that is the question of submarines. And as you, I'm sure, undoubtedly know, the current Thai administration is continuing the efforts of the to indigenously produce submarines. And so the question, and you addressed this in part, but perhaps is that should the United States support Taiwan's quest for submarines?
I would defer to David. He wrote a fantastic article this morning on this very question.
That's true.
Sure. The U.S., the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, did approve entire submarines in the early 2000s. So it was approved by the U.S. government, by the State Department. So then Taiwan has still chosen to go with indigenous submarine program instead to start to do the design and building. I'm writing three articles in the Global Taiwan Brief about this. I think it's going to be easier for international cooperation for other countries, U.S., other countries, to work with Taiwan the direction that Taiwan's going compared to the entire submarine, because when you break the submarine down into components, you can export components of submarines in the millions of dollars, $5, $10 million, up to even more, more quietly and with less public affairs influence or influence from other countries. So this move of breaking it down seems like a way that the U.S. can work more practically with Taiwan on that. And of course, the U.S. Did approve entire submarines back in the early 2000s. However, that did not go forward at the time.
David, could I just ask you a question? Because I know you have regional expertise, certainly very much on Taiwan, but also across the entire region. When we talk to our other allies and partners, like Japan, for example, or South Korea, who also face extremely stressful security environments, do we say to them that your capital ships are useless and they'll be easily plinked in the event of war? Do we say you can never buy enough to make a difference? Do we say you should move to asymmetric, small, distributed things because it makes it easier for us to sell those kind of things where it's hard, we're under pressure from the Chinese not to sell the other? Do we tell them to go with mini-subs? Do we tell them F-16s or F-35s are not suited for them? How does that work? How, from the State Department perspective?
Former.
What did you see? Did you see us talking to our other allies the way we talked to Taiwan? Because, and Alex, I agree with you. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with your prescriptions, but I agree with you that this is, and your statements do represent the conventional wisdom, I would say the weight of wisdom from OSD and from a lot of corners in the United States government. And so I just wonder, if I disagree with some of that conventional wisdom, but I just wonder, from the State Department perspective, do we also treat other countries that way? Do we try to talk them out of doing things that they want to do in this regard?
You're right. The situation is different. So, but you make a good point.
So we don't, or you can't confirm or deny.
You're right. I mean, when the U.S. works, I covered South Korea, Japan, throughout East Asia. I also covered Israel, which is kind of interesting. East Asia and Israel. You're right. The situation with defense. The U.S. actively supports Taiwan, like I said, in accordance with Taiwan Relations Act. But I mean, South Korea, I believe, operates like 9 submarines. And you know, Japan, and this is just a very just in terms of the U.S. relationship with other countries in the East Asia region, especially partners. But then Korea and Japan are mutual defense treaty allies, and Taiwan is no longer. So there's also a difference there.
So how about Singapore? Because we don't have an alliance with Singapore. Can we try to talk them out of buying new F-15s, or what about, I don't know, Indonesia, who we're selling F-16s to, or Iraq? We're also selling F-16s to, or Pakistan.
Yeah.
Do we tell them these are not going to be very useful for you guys?
I think you're making a very good point.
That's great. Alex, did you want to respond?
I think the sharpness of your point would be too much. You know, I'd be struck to the heart if we were not also the United States having to consider whether short leg tactical fighters are good for us in general in a military sense, right? And I think there are a growing number of people who say not only should Taiwan and Japan and South Korea not necessarily be buying short leg tactical fighters, but the United States shouldn't be buying short leg tactical fighters because you know, their lumpy capital with a limited capability in a realm of wide, of diffused precision guided munitions. So, you know, you know, the United States certainly, even Japan, other states, probably less so Indonesia and Singapore, can afford to make mistakes and bad investments in their defense portfolio. In a way that I don't think Taiwan can, unless the political will for defense spending or economic growth changes dramatically. I take your point. I don't know anything about Israel, and I, you know, I'm not qualified to comment on the Middle East. But I take your point about why this disjuncture seems so jarring today, and I take your point that clearly there are political factors that are weighing upon decision makers as well. That doesn't mean that it's not a good shift long term. And you know, if anything, the political skittishness of U.S. leaders, if that's how you want to characterize it, may save Taiwan quite a bit of heartache down the road. And I don't think from Taiwan's side we can say that the Taiwan government is without its own pathologies when it comes to, I mean, certainly there are people thinking critically about defense issues in Taiwan, and I would never denigrate the professionalism of the Taiwan military, but services, the USN and the USAF and the USA included, like big shiny stuff, and it's not always the best bang for your buck, especially when you are the sort of highest probability entity in the entire world that's going to face the full brunt of a PLA onslaught in like not all that long potentially. So I just think the stakes are a little bit higher for Taiwan that make the margin of error in terms of investment a little bit thinner. So I take your point, but I think that there, I would still, I think the conventional wisdom is the conventional wisdom for good analytical reasons and not solely because, Taiwan is kind of its own special case politically.
Well, Alex, just one last two fingers.
Okay, one last one. Because we have four colleagues there. You go.
I certainly didn't mean to criticize you particularly.
No, I didn't take it that way. I understand.
Just with U.S. policy. My issues with U.S. policy more broadly is that whether or not anything makes tactical sense when we do war games, and CNES and some others, but especially your organization, is one of the very best. There's no question about that. That sometimes what things make sense tactically don't make sense strategically, and I think it doesn't make sense for my government strategically to tell another government, you shouldn't buy all the things that you're asking for. We're going to sell the exact same things to everybody else in the world, but not you. It doesn't make sense for you. I think that just sends a very bad signal when we second guess Taiwan's defense planners and guys who have looked at the same threat for 40 years. Some of these guys, their entire career, they've planned on this threat. They've thought about this threat. They war game it out every year. Some of these guys war game it out every few months. And so if they say, I can't tell you why, but we really think we need these capabilities, I don't think we should second guess that. We don't do that with our other allies and security partners, and I don't think we should do that with Taiwan.
Oh, thank you. And that was a very riveting discussion. But I do want to get some questions in here before we close out for today's seminar. And so in the interest of time, I'm going to take 2 to 3 questions at once. Okay. That gentleman, and then Iris, and Peter. Maybe wait for the mic. Oh, this gentleman right here in the blue suit. Yep. Mm-hmm. And state your name and your affiliation.
My name is Tony Liao from Central News Agency Taiwan. Thanks for the panelists. Such insightful and fantastic discussion of the detail about the policy execution. It's really, really wonderful. And I'm going to focus on submarine. The DOD officer had put out such a lengthy statement or assessment about Taiwan's submarine program last week. They have great concern about the safety of the transfer of the technology. They also care about the cost efficiency of Taiwan made by themselves. Both sides had made their position so clear. So at this point, what should we do? How to cooperate at this point from both sides about the precision to make this program putting forward? Thank you.
Thank you. And then Iris, Iris in the red.
Hi, Iris Shaw of DPP US Mission. I'd like to pull back to the earlier part of discussion on the maritime issue. I agree with Alex when you said Taiwan didn't relinquish all the claims. It feels like an old and even really shrill response to a lot of analysts in town. But I'd like to point out the nuances versus that in the statement in response to the Hague arbitration, we didn't talk about the historical waters. We didn't mention about the 9 dash lines, so that's a depart from the former Ma government. Also, quietly and proactively, we are establishing maritime dialogue, the formal official dialogue with Japan, as well as going through trying to enhance the relations with the Southeast Asian and Indo-Pacific countries like India and Australia through the new southbound policy at the presidential level. President Tsai did repeatedly reiterate that it's Taiwan's wish to be involved in the multilateral mechanism of dialogues, and this we believe this is the way to go. So what would the panelists gauge the possibility of U.S. to take more leads on encouraging Taiwan to participate in multilateral dialogues? Just throw out there wildly, be it the cues or the code of conduct, and this is maybe too wild, but quietly or publicly, help Taiwanese domestic to gain this confidence internationally instead of feeling squeezed and the pressure.
And last question, the gentleman with the nice beard over there.
All right, Peter Wood, Jamestown Foundation. There was a time when U.S. maritime surveillance aircraft operated off of Taiwan, when U.S. airmen operated surface-to-air missile systems on Taiwan. My question for the panelists is, how do you perceive the upper bound of U.S.-Taiwan maritime or more general defense cooperation under the Taiwan Relations Act? There's been a wide range of opinions, obviously, but I'm just kind of curious how you guys imagine what's the highest level that we could reach. Obviously, lots of lower level exchanges and things happening, but what's the maximum that we could do under the Taiwan Relations Act before something else had to happen legislatively?
Great. So submarines, maritime space, and TRA. So go.
Okay. I can't give you a very clear way forward on the submarine issue. I think David's point was well taken, that the way that the Tsai government appears to be going does allow more flexibility for all kinds of partners to sell components rather than selling the whole shebang. And I think many of us have probably seen that sad little ring of pressure hull that sits at China Shipbuilding Corporation shipyard in Kaohsiung, which they built just after the Bush administration authorized submarines to say, yeah, we can do this, and it just sits there, and it's kind of pathetic. But with this way forward, I think there's more flexibility for people to participate at a level that they're comfortable with. On maritime space or international space, I think that. First of all, I don't think Taiwan should participate in the code of conduct, because that's a fruitless endeavor anyway. So you don't want that. I don't think anyone should want that for Taiwan. I think that I'm being flippant, but that's probably a non-starter. But I do think there are a number of places that Taiwan should be involved. So APEC, of which Taiwan is a member, has some dialogues on maritime transportation and maritime safety and, related issues that I think Taiwan Taiwan's presence should be upgraded at. There's the heads of Asian Coast Guard something meeting, which is a multilateral dialogue to discuss Coast Guard issues, and I think Taiwan's participation there with U.S. support would be a good thing. The big get. The hardest fight, obviously, is going to be some sort of, even at the NGO level, participation in the International Maritime Organization. So obviously, since that's a UN body, direct participation from Taipei is going to be difficult, given opposition from Beijing. But I think there is some precedent for, looking at unofficial participation from Taipei, and I think that would be good. And I generally support, efforts by the Taiwan government to increase their own international space, and I think as a general principle, the United States should be supportive of that as well. I also want to mention, I'm glad you raised Taiwan's recent dialogue with Japan. From both sides, I think we would like, everyone would like to see, everyone in the region except for maybe one person would like, one actor would like to see Taiwan and Japan cooperate more. It's very natural from, the economic synergies, the economic links, overall, I think friendly people-to-people relations, a number of factors make that a good thing.
And from a security perspective, I think it may actually generate a lot of positive exchange between the two, because Japan has, it's a little bit removed in history, but Japan's military knows how to do point defense and island defense, and they've studied that quite a bit. The United States doesn't do that. You know, we take islands through power projection. We don't defend them, or at least that's what we did in the Pacific War. So I think there are some ways in which professional exchanges, you know, of some kind between between Taiwan and Japan would be helpful. Obviously, that depends on sort of a surfeit of political will in both Taipei and Tokyo, but I think it's a good development, and so I commend Ben and Tsai for that initiative. And then the last question was on the upper bound of the TRA. That is an excellent question, one that I don't feel qualified to. I mean, you know, there's an old sort of adage about Washington that you know, mostly you tell a government lawyer to interpret the law to make something legal, and they'll try their best to do so and often succeed. But I don't feel qualified to do that, so you'd have to ask, you know, DOD Ledge Affairs or what have you. But you know, I think while it would behoove us to every administration to think harder about Taiwan policy in general at the outset, you know, when they're doing their strategic rethink of all foreign policy issues, to include Taiwan as a priority in that sort of thinking is good, and that would certainly be a question for them to discuss. I think that for now we should think more about you know, the art of the possible, and so some of the things like training on Guam, stuff that's not quite as sensitive as testing that upper bound, for the moment is probably more advisable. Sorry to ramble on.
All right. So submarines, Taiwan's international space, and upper bound of U.S.-Taiwan. U.S. support for Taiwan under the Taiwan Relations Act. Submarines first. Submarines are going to be expensive no matter what. So Taiwan has dedicated $95 million just for the early design phase. And the numbers I've seen so far is going to go into the billions of dollars for the entire process. It's just an expensive platform. Taiwan can save money, or at least prevent the risk of overspending, if it buys commercial off the shelf. So if Taiwan might, I don't know if it does, might be tempted to lament prices that seem high from foreign defense companies. However, those are known quantities. If Taiwan, whether out of frustration or out of high foreign price, decides to build on its own, then you're reinventing the wheel with research and development. You're not benefiting from the economy of scale. Taiwan might go for 4, 6, 8, maybe later build more. The U.S. throughout its history has built 800 submarines. That is research development costs spread over hundreds of platforms, other countries in Europe as well. If you spread among hundreds of platforms, the per unit costs drops a lot. So that would be my recommendation. It will be tempting, I think, for Taiwan as it tries to approach companies, foreign companies. If it's having a hard time, it'll be more and more tempting to say, hey, CSIST, Zhongshan Kejin, Zhuyuan, let's just do it ourselves. But keep in mind, if you do it yourself, it could balloon to be many more times how much you thought it would cost. So that's submarines right there, economy of scale. International space. So in addition to Taiwan pursuing the high politics, I've often said and written that Taiwan should be going for functional, which it is, ICAO and these various organizations, and then also epistemic communities, communities of scientists, academics, political scientists, American Political Science Association. They build bonds, and they influence each other's thinkings, and they make friends. These are ways, not just in the high politics area of UN and everything, but also at the functional and grassroots level. And also, in terms of what's allowed under Taiwan's Relations Act, the upper bounds, that might be a question that's a little like brinksmanship, like how close can I get to the edge before I fall off the edge? And usually, I think, my thought about that is to try not to get close, you know. And of course, like, there's sometimes different countries will talk about red lines in the region, certain platforms, so you have an indication there of what might be beyond the brink. But my view is we should not try to find out what the limit is, because you might go over the edge. But I'm sure my colleague Ian will disagree with me.
I do like, you know, that's one of the things that's really fun about being in a think tank is you do get to be a lot more edgy. You get to think outside the box a little bit more. You get to be critical of U.S. policy. You don't have to defend it. And you can kind of think of what are the questions that are unthinkable, right? What are the questions that right now no one dares think? Because I want to think those questions. I want to do research on that. And I want to talk to people about that and find out what they think about it. Because maybe we're not thinking about some of the things that we ought to be thinking about. I mean, that's where innovation comes from, right? If you don't ever take a risk, then you'll never succeed. By definition, all success comes from risk. Ask anybody in Silicon Valley, and they'll tell you that no company has ever succeeded, ever, without taking huge risks, and in many cases, huge losses. And so I think countries, sometimes, especially when they face very grave peril, should be thinking about seeing where the limits are, instead of just hunkering down and saying, please, Beijing, leave me alone, because you know that's not going to happen. We all know that's not going to happen. What I've learned from both you, Alex, and you, David, is that numbers matter. Large numbers of dispersed capabilities matter, and that economy of scale matters. I learned that this morning reading an article, and I agree. I totally agree, and it makes me wonder that, in terms of submarines, if Taiwan should be thinking about more than 8, right? Maybe 20, maybe 32. And maybe since this is a very long-term program that's going to play out not over the course of months or years, but over the course of decades, Taiwan should be thinking about where are we going to be in 2030 or 2040? Where do we want to be? Maybe Taiwan will be in a position to start exporting subs as well. So if subs are important to Taiwan, and they clearly are, that is a bipartisan issue. It's one of the very few bipartisan issues in Taiwan. You have two administrations who, in many respects, could not be more different from each other. And they both agree on the importance of the Indigenous Defense Submarine Program. I think that is a very positive thing. And I think then it warrants further thought. Maybe more than 8 submarines. And I'm sure the Navy has very good reasons for that number, the 6 to 8 number. But maybe a higher number might be warranted, especially if some of these trends that you talked about, Alex, actually happen. And I think they probably will. And so in that kind of environment, it makes sense to have more than just a few subs. So that might be an area. But to your question, Tony, on cooperation, the easiest thing that we could do, that Washington could do, is just to show support, to tell U.S. defense companies that it's okay to be involved. It's okay to compete and to try to get contracts. Right now, there's just a blanket restriction on everybody, that they're being strongly discouraged and actually rejected when they try to help Taiwan, because that's the policy right now. And it's in flux. It's dynamic. A few months from now, that policy could change. But that's the way it is now, and that's the way it's been ever since the Taiwanese government announced the program. And so just to stop interfering in it, to stop trying to undermine it and second-guess it, I think that's not a lot to ask. That's setting the bar very low. That's not even asking the U.S. government to do what it promised to do back in 2001. Because, as David said, we did promise Taiwan 8 diesel electric submarines. We have not delivered on that promise. Could we? We are the United States of America. Are you kidding me? Of course we could. We could easily buy 8 diesel subs from Greece or France or Sweden or Germany or any of the other countries in the world that make them. We could buy them, reflag them, and give them to Taiwan. We could have done that a long time ago. We could build them ourselves. We could support and then provide them. We could have built them in Taiwan. There's so many things we could do if we had backbone. But we don't. We lack that. And so my hope is that a few months from now, we'll have a new president who will be a little more forward-leaning, a little more interested in the long-term defense technology trends that we're up against here, and be a little more strategic and a little more positive with helping Taiwan defend itself. At a bare minimum, I think that's what we should be doing, and we could, certainly could, if we had leaders that were willing to do that. We don't right now.
All right. And with that, although we are over schedule, I think the discussion, the enriched discussions that we've had afterwards made it all worth it. Please join me in giving a round of applause to our panelists. And just for your all information, our next public seminar series will be held in 2 weeks, and the event will be on cybersecurity. So please stay tuned to receive the email invitation in your inbox. Thank you.